And you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and for the next hour, you will be listening to Radio Naturopath. I had a patient come in not too long ago who was very concerned about gastroesophageal reflux disorder. And I do talk about that as part of other shows, but I was looking through the archives to see if I had talked about it in general in the entirety of a show. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into it, and this is going to be basically what this show is about. So let's talk about gastroesophageal reflux disorder. So you've got heartburn, right? Yeah. Sometimes you get heartburn and, you know, you're just getting some indigestion, and you just feel that sensation of a burning in your heart. So let me say a few things about that. One of the symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux So first of all, we have to define our terms. What is gastroesophageal reflux? Yeah. So it's really common. I don't know what the stats are, but it's so common. I see so many patients come in. They're on medication for it. They get endoscopies and get it diagnosed. And it's very, very common. And I think as we get older, we're more likely to have at least some symptoms of heartburn. First of all, you get chest pain. You may have pain in your chest. And if you have sudden, scary chest pain, that's a medical emergency, and you really have to go to the ER. So the ER being the emergency room, because chest pain can be a heart attack, and you never know if it's really a heart attack. Now, if you know what your heartburn feels like, you may be okay, and if you take an antacid and it gets better, it may just be indigestion. But you can't be too careful. And if you've got heartburn that doesn't go away, or you've got chest pain that doesn't go away, and you're not sure about it, it is a good idea to go to the ER, because chest pain is a medical emergency. Also, acute abdominal pain is a medical emergency, because it really has to be worked up, and there are chances it could be something quite serious. So if you have determined that your heartburn is in fact that your pain in your chest is in fact heartburn, and it is coming from your digestive system, and you've been diagnosed with reflux disorder, let's talk about what our terms mean. So heartburn is just a symptom. Heartburn is the symptom that you get where you have a burning sensation in your chest that's arising from something to do with your stomach. Let's also define the term stomach. So this is interesting. What's an esophagus? What's a stomach? When people point to their stomach, they say, I have stomach pain, and they just mean their abdomen. But your stomach is not the same thing as your whole abdomen. We have the colloquial term stomach, where you point to everything below your nipples. That's all considered to be your stomach. But anatomically, that is not your stomach. Your stomach is only one part of what's going on in there. So you have this tube that goes from the back of your throat down to, well, your actual stomach. And your stomach is the holding tank for your food. So the first thing that happens is you chew your food. You look at your food and you go, I want to eat that food. Yum, yum, yum. And your brain goes, oh, I'm about to eat food. Yay. And then the first thing you'll do is salivate. And so saliva is going to come out in your mouth, and it's going to do this cool thing where you go, yum, 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 yum. And you chew on the food, and you mix the food with saliva. Saliva doesn't do very much in terms of digesting your food. It just mixes it up, and it has a little bit of one enzyme in it called amylase. So it does start to break down starches that you are eating. That's why if you take a piece of bread and you chew on it for long enough, it's going to start to taste really sweet, because you're breaking apart the starches into sugars with that amylase that's in your saliva. All right, so you chew, 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 chew. Then you go, and you swallow, and now it's going to go down your esophagus. And esophagus is a nice tube that goes from back of your throat, and then it travels down, and it stops at about, if you can touch yourself at the bottom of your sternum, which is your breastbone, that's about where that esophagus stops and turns into your stomach. There is a little ring of muscle between your esophagus and your stomach. It's called the lower esophageal sphincter. A sphincter is a ring of muscle that opens and closes. It has a hole in the middle for stuff to pass through, and it opens and closes. So that is one of the places in your body where you have, in fact, a sphincter. Okay, so this sphincter has pressure on it by food. It opens up. Food goes into the stomach. Now, the stomach is a big old pouch. Most of the body of the stomach is on the left side of your upper abdomen. So if you care to touch your abdomen right now, not if you're driving, on the left side, you will find that you'll find you have ribs, and under those ribs, that's where your stomach, that's where most of your stomach is. If you go to the right side, right across from your stomach, that's all liver. Most of that is liver. But on the left side, and it is possible to have dextroposition of the stomach, but it's very, very rare. So most of the time, most of your stomach is on the left side. A little bit of it crosses the midline, but mostly it's on the left side. It sort of jogs to the left. That's how that goes. Kind of because you got this big old liver on the other side. The liver's enormous. It's this really, really big, extremely wicked, important organ. The stomach is interesting because it's a holding tank. Not a whole lot of digestion happens in the stomach. You do absorb some things in the stomach, like medium chain triglycerides. Those are medium length fats, as are found in coconut and coconut oil and some other nuts and nut oils. So they can be absorbed in the stomach. But like I said, not a whole lot is absorbed in the stomach. The job of the stomach is to serve as an initial station. It's the initial place where food is prepared for digestion and absorption. So what goes on in the stomach is you shoot out digestive juices, mostly hydrochloric acid, and you have parietal cells and chief cells that shoot out hydrochloric acid. You have the parietal cells also shooting out intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is a very important factor that aids in the absorption of vitamin B12. And so that happens in the stomach, but you do not absorb vitamin B12 in the stomach. You really don't absorb much in the way of minerals in the stomach either. But what you do is you mix your food. Your food gets mechanically mushed up and broken down. The surface of the stomach has these cool things on them called rugae. I just like saying that. Rugae. So the inside of the stomach is kind of rough. And so the stomach gurgles around and mushes and moves, and those rugae go up against your food, and it's a rough surface by which the food can be sort of mushed apart and broken down. And at the same time, it's all being mixed up with hydrochloric acid. So hydrochloric acid is not a bad thing. It is a very good thing, and that's one of the things that I have to emphasize over and over again. You don't want to have less hydrochloric acid in general. You might want to have less of it for a little while you're healing something, but most of the time you want to have hydrochloric acid because it plays a very important role. This is one of those situations. Hydrochloric acid and cholesterol, much, much maligned. Two very, very important articles in your body. They are both necessary to life, and they are very maligned, and we do stuff to take them out of our bodies because we think they're bad, and they are not bad. My goodness, they're very, very good for you. So hydrochloric acid is super important. What it does is, you see, when you eat protein, right? Protein has what we call, wait for it, quaternary structure. It has four levels of structure. That's what quaternary means. It's got the level of disulfide bonds, then it's got polypeptides, it's got amino acid chains, and it's got straight up amino acids. So what happens is when you are in the stomach, it's the highest level of structure that gets broken down. So what that means is when you have disulfide bonds in proteins, that's what gives protein its shape. So when you look at me, I know you can't see me, right? But I have curly hair. So people with curly hair have a lot of disulfide bonds in their hair, and that's what makes the hair curly. So when you heat that hair, it can straighten out. Well, same thing with the hydrochloric acid. It takes out those disulfide bonds, so it straightens out the proteins. And so that's all it does. So the protein structure is all, you've got your disulfide. Now, it's all still hooked together, your polypeptides and your amino acids. And so when you break those down, now it's flatter and it's easier for protease to go in and start breaking things up. So you break down your polypeptides into peptide chains and then into amino acids. And the amino acids are what you ultimately absorb. And that happens in your small intestine at the behest of protease enzyme. And protease enzyme comes from your pancreas. It's one of the pancreatic enzymes. It's shot from the pancreas, but via ducts into the small intestine and starts breaking down the proteins. But in your stomach, all that's really happening is hydrochloric acid is mixing up with protein and it's flattening it out, taking out those disulfide bonds so it can get into your small intestine and start be worked on by proteolytic enzymes. That's what's going on there. The other thing that's happening is hydrochloric acid is mixing with the food and it's going to serve as a cofactor to change the pH so that you are then able to absorb other stuff. And that other stuff gets absorbed again in the small intestine. The small intestine is the land of absorption. That's where that happens. Those little finger-like projections, villi, those are responsible for absorbing stuff. All right. So you have to have hydrochloric acid present to absorb calcium, magnesium, potassium, iron, and vitamin B12. Those are all necessary. Hydrochloric acid is necessary for absorbing all those stuff. We know this because when you block your hydrochloric acid, you get deficiencies of all of those things. And what happens when you get deficiency of iron? Anemia. Yep. What happens when you get deficiencies of calcium, magnesium? Bone density issues, fractures, osteopenia, osteoporosis. So if you take acid blockers for long enough, that's what happens. So anyway, the other thing that hydrochloric acid does is it disinfects your food. So surprise, surprise, there's bacteria and other microorganisms on your food. Now, some of those bacteria you want, some of them are probiotics. So if you're eating healthy, very healthy produce from a very clean source, there's going to be wonderful probiotic bacteria on that food. And you don't want all of that to be killed. And not all of it is going to get killed. It is going to go through your entire digestive system and make it down through your small intestine and then into your colon. And most of it's going to set up in your colon and give you wonderful be among those trillions of microbiome, those wonderful bacteria that are in your large intestine. The large intestine is called the colon because it's where the colonies are, the colonies of bacteria, viruses, fungi, and yeasts, all kinds of cool microorganisms that are living in there. And hopefully you have a preponderance of what we call probiotic organisms. Probiotics are the symbiotes. They are the great microorganisms that help you to have a happier life. They do wonderful things for you. They're so happy to be in your large intestine that they do great things like make vitamins, make detoxifying compounds. They make antimicrobial compounds. They'll kill bad guys. They make compounds that keep you regular, like they make acids. Because inside of you, you want to be acidic, and acids stimulate the digestive system to contract. So you're more regular. So that's one of the ways that probiotics will keep you out of constipation. So they do all kinds of really fabulous things for you, and you want to have a good proportion of probiotic bacteria. All right, getting back up there to the stomach. So that's our focus today. What's going on in the stomach to give you heartburn, gastroesophageal reflux, all that stuff. All right, so we've gotten into the normal stomach. The stomach, the hydrochloric acid of the stomach is supposed to be disinfecting your food. Okay, so now you have a situation where you're starting to be symptomatic. So what could be causing those symptoms? Well, there's a few things. One is that you could have gastritis. Now, the way to get your stomach investigated generally, first of all, you go to the doctor and the doctor will poke around at your stomach. They'll say, does this hurt? Does that hurt? They'll tap on your stomach to see if you have gas, all kinds of stuff. So there's a lot of information we can get just by, you know, a cursory examination. If we check your lymph nodes, we can see if those are enlarged in your neck. We can look in your throat and we can see if you have redness in your throat, because sometimes if you have redness in your throat, it's because you're getting reflux into your throat and it's burning your throat. We can also see, unfortunately, if your tooth enamel is going, because if you're getting reflux at night and you don't realize it, it's going to start wearing away at your tooth enamel. So that's another thing we can see. We can see erosion sometimes in your mouth. We can see erosions in your mouth, your tongue, the back of your throat. So it's a whole bunch of stuff like that. Those that we can see in a cursory examination. We can also, like I said, press on your belly and get some information there. If you have pain primarily in what we call the epigastric region, so epi means above and gastric refers to the stomach. So that place right above your stomach, that's going to be in the center of your chest below your breastbone. People with reflux disorder tend to have discomfort right there. You press on it and they're like, ooh, that hurts. Or they jump off the table or they smack you, something like that. No, I don't know that I've actually ever been smacked. I did yank a doctor's hand out of my throat when he's doing an endonasal on me, but that's a story for another day. Anyway, so you have this heartburn, unfortunately, and there could be a few reasons why you have it. One could be that you have actual gastritis. Gastritis means the stomach. That's the actual anatomical stomach. The inner lining of it is inflamed. Well, how does that happen? Well, guess what? There's a few ways that that can happen. As we get older, believe it or not, we make less hydrochloric acid, not more. And so people think that the reason that they have reflux is because they have too much hydrochloric acid. That's generally not true. What's going on is you have not enough hydrochloric acid. And so when you don't have enough hydrochloric acid, your food is not getting adequately mixed with it. You may also have less mucus. And so you have a vicious cycle going on. You have less mucus. You have less hydrochloric acid. The food that's coming in doesn't get mixed with mucus and hydrochloric acid. And so it sits there and it irritates and inflames the lining of the stomach. Now, it's natural to have some level of this funky bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. We all have some in our stomachs. We don't all make antibodies to it, but it's an opportunistic infection. So if the lining of your stomach is breached, that is, you don't have enough mucus, you don't have enough hydrochloric acid, and it's being exposed to food in general, and in some cases to foods that are higher in inflammation, you're going to get inflammation on the lining of that stomach. And the more it's exposed, you can actually get ulcerations. Well, this is a perfect opportunity for that Helicobacter pylori to get in there and flourish, and then you might get an ulceration, and the Helicobacter pylori will further that ulceration. So if it's determined that you have Helicobacter pylori, that can be determined in a number of ways. You can do a blood test to find out if you have antibodies to Helicobacter pylori, if you're making proteins that are fighting the Helicobacter pylori. You can also have a biopsy, and you can also do a breath test, and that's a relatively non-invasive way to do it. You breathe into a bag and there are particular gases that Helicobacter pylori gives off, and they can actually measure that in a bag. It's kind of interesting. There are a number of bacterial tests that you can do to see what's going on in terms of it. They're relatively gross tests, and I don't mean gross disgusting. I mean that gross in terms of, so if you're testing to see if somebody has small intestinal bacterial overgrowth based on whether they're producing too much hydrogen versus too much methane, you can get an idea of what kinds of bacteria are there, but not necessarily a specific species. There is a breath test that will test for Helicobacter pylori. So if you have that, then you're going to wind up probably from your MD getting the triple antibiotic therapy, where you might get carafate, which is a solution that's kind of a starch that covers and coats the inside of your digestive system to help it to heal. Plus, you'll get some antibiotics to help to slow things down and get rid of the Helicobacter pylori. And you'll probably also get an acid blocker, usually a proton pump inhibitor. And your things that end in prazole, like lipomeprazole, ensoprazole, esomeprazole, pantoprazole. There's a whole bunch of prazoles, and they are proton pump inhibitors. That's what those guys are. Okay, so anyway, so that's one mechanism. You could have gastritis, that is an inflammation of the lining of your stomach, which can be diagnosed by a procedure called an endoscopy. An endoscopy is where you get anesthetized, and then they put a scope down into your nose, usually your nose through your throat, and then into your stomach, and they take a look around. If there's anything that shouldn't be there, if there's polyps or anything that they think they need to look at, they also can grab at it and biopsy it. And so they do that. They usually take tissue samples. So if they see an area of gastritis, they will take a sample from that piece of gastritis, and then they'll look at it under a microscope and figure out what's going on. When they do an endoscopy, they look around at the whole stomach. So they pass this scope all the way through your esophagus into your stomach. They take a look around the whole stomach, and then they pass it partway through your stomach into the pylorus, which is the first part of your small intestine, into the duodenum. Duodenum is the first long part of your small intestine, where the pylorus is the juncture between the stomach, where the stomach turns into small intestine, and there is a sphincter down there as well. So they go through that sphincter, look around in the pylorus, and then they go into the duodenum and they look around in there too. The duodenum is another place you can get ulcers commonly because it's close to the stomach. It's the first place that's supposed to get hit by proteolytic enzymes and other enzymes. And sometimes, it doesn't make it. You get food sitting there and you can get ulcerations there as well. So duodenal ulcers are relatively common too. That's the duodenum is the other place where they're going to look for celiac disease. They're going to look for changes in the villi, those finger-like projections that absorb your food in all along your small intestine. And they're going to take samples of those as well. And then they're going to let you know if you have any changes in your villi. So that's what the endoscope can do for you. And the endoscope, like I said, can diagnose ulcers in the stomach. It can diagnose ulcers in the duodenum and also changes in the villi. And of course, it can look around and can see if there are tumors and masses and things like that. Okay, so what they're doing is they're looking, there's a scope and they're looking at a camera while they're doing it. And then they're also taking samples of stuff if they need to do that. All right, so that's that. So then you have your lower esophageal sphincter. Rock and roll. So lower esophageal sphincter is a big deal, okay? And when you're pressing on that spot below your sternum, but your breastbone, and it's sore, that's usually what's sore, that lower esophageal sphincter. So if you can mess up that lower esophageal sphincter. How can you do that? Well, you can eat foods that tend to make it relax too much. And the foods that tend to make it relax too much, you're not going to like to hear this. It's coffee, tea, chocolate, spicy, tomato, citrus, all of those guys, peppermint, mints. So if you're a big gum chewer or you're a big mint eater and you tend to get reflux, the mint may not be helping you. So here's the thing about mint. Mint is often thought of as a digestive aid. And it is because it calms the digestive system down. So if you have irritable bowel syndrome, if you have any symptoms where you get a lot of cramping in your digestive system, mint is awesome. The problem is mint is awesome everywhere. It's also awesome on the lower esophageal sphincter. So if you have a lot of reflux, that mint doesn't care where it's relaxing. It doesn't care if you happen to be getting cramps in your small intestine or large intestine. It's going to relax everything. So it's also going to relax your lower esophageal sphincter. And I know for me, peppermint tea is not one of my favorite things because I tend to get a little heartburn when I drink it. It relaxes my lower esophageal sphincter too much, even though it tastes really good. I have to be careful how much mint I eat because I get that. It happens. So if you're a gum chewer and you have esophageal reflux, you might want to rethink that. If you like gum, so get another flavor. If you want something that's going to refresh your mouth, you can look for gum that's made with licorice or fennel. Some flavors that are, or clove that are refreshing, or cinnamon, things that are relaxing and not going to relax your lower esophageal sphincter. Or you can get ginger gum, and those are going to refresh your mouth as well, but not have the problems that the mint is going to have. So that's something to be aware of. And so the other thing, so that lower esophageal sphincter can get irritated and inflamed if you eat food intolerances. So then don't forget the big bullies of digestion. Shout out to Jillian Sarno-Tita for coming up with that term, the big bullies of digestion. Big bullies of digestion, a la Fran, are going to be processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, especially coffee. But quite honestly, tea's going to be an issue as well. And gluten, dairy, grains, and GMOs. So all of those things are going to be the big bullies of digestion. So they're going to be more likely to cause inflammation. They can also mess with your lower esophageal sphincter. And they can mess with it by making it relax, but they more often than mess with it by making it inflame. So if you've got a lower esophageal sphincter that's relaxing because you're eating foods that relax it, plus you are eating foods that inflame it, the thing's not going to close very well. And beyond that, there's another problem, and that's that your lower esophageal sphincter likes to know that it's got adequate food in it before it goes and closes. The way it knows it has adequate food is because it has adequate hydrochloric acid in it. So When you have a pH scale has to do with the concentration of hydrogen ions in something. So when there's a high concentration, so just bear with me here, all right? Because this is, it's a logarithmic scale. What the heck is a logarithm? Logarithm is something to the power of something else. So, all right. So you have something to the power of 10. That means, so say you have 1 to the power of 10. That means 1 times 1 times 1 times 1, etc. until you get to 10. So when you have 2 to the power of 10, that's 2 times 2 times 2, 10 times. So let's flip that. The logarithmic scale, the pH scale, is actually 10 to the power of 1, 2, 3, etc. That's what the pH scale is. So a pH of 1 has to do with how much, what your concentration of hydrogen ions is. So when you have a low pH, you have lots of hydrogen ions. When you have a high pH, you have high hydroxyl ions, oxygen and hydrogen. So it has to do with the concentration of hydrogen ions. I think it's the reciprocal of the concentration of hydrogen ions. That's how it works. That's how you get lots of hydrogen ions with a low number, not very many hydrogen ions with a high number. But the concentration of hydroxyl ions is going up inversely. So anyway, your stomach, in order to function optimally, needs a high concentration of hydrochloric acid, and it needs to be at a pH of at least 2. If it's not a 2, if it's like 2.5 or 3 or 4, because you're not making so much hydrochloric acid, that lower esophageal sphincter is not going to close all the way. So guess what happens if you've got food in your stomach and your lower esophageal sphincter hasn't closed all the way? Remember I told you when the food gets into your stomach, the stomach goes and mushes it around and it's got rugae in it and it pushes against the food and it sloshes everything around? Well, if you've got a half-open lower esophageal sphincter, what do you think is going to happen to that food? You're going to get backwash. It's going to go pressure right up against that sphincter, which is partially open, right into your esophagus. Unfortunately, your esophagus is not covered in rugae. It's not as rough as the stomach, and your esophageal sphincter can get burned. It can get irritated by the hydrochloric acid. My thinking is it's a poor design. It doesn't make sense to me why the esophagus would be designed that way. Got to talk to the big engineer. But The fact is, if that lower esophageal sphincter doesn't close all the way, you get backflow into that esophagus. And after long enough, hydrochloric acid gets up there. It starts to irritate and inflame that esophagus. So you want that lower esophageal sphincter to close. That's really important. You want to make it close. And that way your hydrochloric acid stays where it's supposed to be. So how is it that you can have lower hydrochloric acid and still get this reflux thing going on? Well, again, if you're not making enough hydrochloric acid in the first place, the pH in your stomach's going to be too high. So that lower esophageal sphincter is not going to feel like closing. Now, if you're sending food down there and everything's getting inflamed because there's not enough hydrochloric acid, there's not enough mucus, now you're going to get backflow against that that lower esophageal sphincter. It's going to get inflamed and it's going to be even less likely to close. What a drag. It's just such a problem. So you've got a few mechanisms here by which this is happening. There is a third very exciting mechanism that I haven't even mentioned yet, and that's the hiatal hernia. Yay, hiatal hernia. No one wants that. And my heart goes out to you if you've got one. So what the heck is a hiatal hernia? Let me tell you, it's no fun. Now we have to talk about the diaphragm. All right, so the diaphragm is this muscle. Diaphragm is it's a round muscle, and its job is to contract when you breathe in. So when you inhale, your diaphragm, see, I just made my diaphragm contract. You exhale, it relaxes. So what does it do? What it's doing is it's contracting, it's pushing the organs in your abdomen out of the way so your lungs can inflate. That's its job. Well, guess what? The esophagus, everything's below it. Everything's supposed to be below it. The things that are above the diaphragm are your heart and your lungs. That's pretty much it for organs. The heart, lungs, lymphatics, the thymus, the thyroid, those are all above the diaphragm. Below the diaphragm, you got everything else. You got stomach, you got liver, you got pancreas, you got gallbladder, you got small and large intestine. Those are all below the diaphragm. Well, that's a lot of stuff, especially the liver. Liver's wicked awesome big. So you got to get that out of the way if you're going to expand those lungs. So you're going to go ahead and, you're going to take a deep breath in. That diaphragm's going to contract and it's going to push everything out of the way so your lungs can inflate. All right. But the esophagus comes from your throat. So, and it has to hook up with your stomach, right? Well, absolutely. So what it does is the esophagus goes down, it goes through a hole in that diaphragm, an anatomical hole, it's supposed to be there, and it goes through and it connects to your stomach, sends the food down. Well, not everybody is blessed with an intact diaphragm. People have spots in various places in their body that are a little thin, and with enough pressure, they can tear. So a hiatal hernia is where you have that place where the esophagus goes through the diaphragm. You can have a weak spot and you can get a tear. Now, the bad thing about getting a tear there is, of course, the diaphragm doesn't work as well. But even worse is that the stomach can pooch up through that tail. And you're still eating food. You're still putting food into your stomach. And that food can get caught in that little pooch that's above the diaphragm, and it has a difficult time emptying because the diaphragm can be cutting it off because it's always expanding and contracting every time you breathe. So you have all this food that's caught up there, and that can cause irritation and inflammation. That's a bad scene. People with hiatal hernias, in my estimation, are harder to treat than people without them if they have gastroesophageal reflux disorder. So here's a cool thing you can do if you have a hiatal hernia. So hiatal hernias can be repaired. There's a couple of treatments that can repair them. One of them is the Lynx treatment. It's where they put a little ring, a little metal ring or a metal or plastic ring over top around the diaphragm to keep that stomach from pooching up through the tear. Also, the tear can be repaired. There's a procedure that you can do to repair a diaphragmatic tear. The only issue is when you get it repaired, it can be more difficult to have backflow through the diaphragm. So if you need to, forgive me, vomit, that can be more difficult. But those are both available options for people with severe hiatal hernias. And quite honestly, most of the time, docs don't like to do either of those procedures. They would rather just put you on medicine because it's invasive and it makes the whole system have more difficulty functioning. So people don't tend to get surgical repairs of hiatal hernias. So here's another fun thing that you can do. So that's completely non-invasive. When you first get up in the morning, hopefully your stomach's empty and you're probably pretty thirsty. I know I am. When I get up in the morning, I wake up in the middle of the night. I'm like, I'm parched, and I go get a glass of water. But you're generally pretty thirsty because you've been sleeping all night. You know, hopefully you've slept up for night 7, 8, 9 hours. And you may not have had anything to drink, maybe a sip of water in the middle of the night. Now you're thirsty. So you go get a glass of water, big glass of water, your favorite temperature, a temperature that you can drink a lot all at once. So super cold might not be the way to go. The other thing is if the water is too cold, you're more likely to cramp, your stomach is more likely to cramp around that water. So I would say pleasantly cold to room temperature is probably ideal because you want to be able to chug it. So you don't want it to be hot either. You want the water to be able to go down easily. And you don't want anything, you probably want to do water and not some other liquid because one of the things that's interesting is overnight you make more hydrochloric acid. That's part of why when you first get up in the morning, you maybe don't want to eat your breakfast right away. You want to get up, move around and do some stuff. And then you want to sit down to eat your breakfast. Because your stomach's not ready for it because you make a lot of hydrochloric acid at night. And that has to settle down. So you're going to feel better if you just have water because that's going to dilute that extra hydrochloric acid that you made overnight, and that'll make you feel better. And you're not going to have anything interacting and stimulating your digestion yet. You're just going to have water. So you take water that's at a reasonable temperature for you to chug, not too hot, not too cold. And you take about 20 to 24 ounces of water and you drink it all down. I mean, you don't have to do it really rapidly, but you want to drink the whole glass of water. And what that's going to do, it's going to make your stomach heavy. So it's going to pull the stomach down, and then you can give it an extra push by jumping up and down. And that's going to pull that heavy stomach down through that hernia. So you've reduced your hernia just by drinking a glass of water and jumping up and down. So we tell our patients who have hiatal hernias that may be helpful for them. Just have a big glass of water in the morning. The other cool thing is that your chiropractor can, if they're knowledgeable, chiropractors are not for backs only. They can adjust anything. They can do adjustments of organs also. People think chiropractors are only for backs, but they're really not. They're really holistic practitioners who can care for the whole body. And it varies by state what their scope of practice is. I think in Connecticut, they're pretty much allowed to do x-rays and order diagnostic imaging and then adjust your back. But there are states where they're allowed to order labs that they can be, I don't know if there are states where they can actually be primary care physicians. They certainly learn all the same stuff we do. It's just they focus on chiropractic manipulation. But I remember when we were Oregon has very liberal chiropractic laws. Have a lot of respect for your chiropractor. Chiropractors are amazing. They can do all kinds of stuff for you. I don't know what I'd do without my chiropractor. My goodness. So shout out to Dr. Suez. Good guy. But chiropractors can adjust your hiatal hernia. And they can adjust other things too. They can adjust your back so that your digestion works better. If you're constipated, you can go to your chiropractor. They can adjust your pelvis and you might have less constipation. So because that way the nerve signaling that's going to your digestive system will work better. I try to go to my chiropractor as often as I can manage. Today might be an option. I don't know. Anyway, so that's another thing you can do to reduce that hiatal hernia. Okay, so now you've been diagnosed with gastroesophageal reflux. What in the heck do you do about it? Well, you have to figure out, are there foods that directly impact you getting reflux? So I think of foods that tend to give you gastroesophageal reflux in two categories. One are inflammatory irritants, and the other are opportunistic irritants. So the opportunistic irritants are you're already irritated by inflammation, and these foods make it worse, but you might not actually have a food intolerance to them. They don't necessarily cause inflammation in your body in general. So the big bullies are the ones that tend to cause inflammation. And it's actually a few of the big ones. So processed food, if you're eating a lot of food that's just not food, that has a lot of chemicals in it, your body doesn't know what to do with chemicals and it gets irritated trying to figure out what the heck to do with them. So if you're eating M&Ms and Skittles, and I'm not saying you should never eat those, but if you have digestive upset, why are you eating candy? It doesn't make sense. So if you're eating a lot of food that has a lot of chemicals in it, your body's going to look at the chemicals and go, what are these things? And it's not going to know what to do with it. The chemicals are going to go right through your system, undigested. They can give you gas and bloating at the other end, and they can irritate you all the way down. So the less processed, that's going to be a really good thing to do. Sugar all by itself causes inflammation. It's very simple. When you eat refined sugar, your body has to do something with it. One of the first things it has to do is kick out insulin. Insulin is the traffic director of the body. Insulin is a wicked important hormone in your body. But you put sugar in your body, your insulin is going to go up. And one of the jobs of insulin is to create inflammation. And not all inflammation is bad. Excessive inflammation is bad. But the reason your body's doing inflammation is because you're doing something to make it inflamed. And the insulin's just responding to that because you need inflammation to initiate repair of whatever you're going to do. You went to the gym today and you lifted a whole bunch of weights. Well, guess what? Insulin's going to come out and it's going to bring out a whole bunch of inflammatory compounds, which are going to mobilize a whole bunch of cells and RNA and DNA and direct protein to go into your muscle cells to rebuild them. And that happens in the setting of a certain amount of healthy inflammation. Insulin causes inflammation. All right, so you go ahead and eat sugar, right? So insulin's going to come out and go, yo, sugar, you need to get out of the blood and you need to get into the cells and power this puppy and get that sugar into the cells so it can run your blood cells. All right, so but the insulin's there, it's going to be setting up inflammatory compounds. So where do you think the inflammation happens if you have too much insulin running around? Oh, I don't know, everywhere. One of the ways you can reduce your allergy symptoms, so say you have, you know, respiratory allergies, like because, you know, the pollen's pretty crazy right now, or you have dust and mold allergies, stop eating sugar. See what happens. Your nose will be clearer. It doesn't care. If you have joint pain, body aches, stomach aches, headaches, it doesn't matter. If you get rid of sugar, you're going to have less inflammation. It causes inflammation, and it's very simple. It increases insulin. Insulin increases inflammatory compounds. You also change your gut flora to a less favorable proportion of microorganisms that also cause inflammation. So sugar, 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 inflammation, inflammation, inflammation. Yo. All right. So sugar can cause inflammation in your digestive system. You inflame the stomach, you inflame the lower esophageal sphincter, you got reflux. All right, so that's the next thing. Alcohol, need I say more? So alcohol is directly toxic to cells. It just kills cells on contact. That's why they, you know, Listerine is now advertising that they have alcohol-free mouthwash because the public got aware of this and they're like, you know what, I don't want alcohol in my mouthwash anymore, because people are starting to get concerned about, you know, they have as a habit, they do a mouth rinse every day, and they're starting to be worried that they're going to initiate oral cancer by getting by using just mouthwash every day. If you drink too much alcohol all the time, alcohol, every surface it touches, it can cause cellular changes. If you're drinking a glass of wine, you know, four times a week or something, you're probably not going to get sick from that. Especially if you're, because the cool thing about wine is wine has lots of antioxidants in it. So it's going to tend to mitigate the problem of the alcohol. But if you drink lots of alcohol, you're going to be more likely to have inflammation in your digestive system. And it's a local irritation. It's that alcohol all by itself, and it's in the process of being metabolized on site. It creates free radicals, and it's going to irritate the tissue. We know that people who drink a lot, one of the things they do is they get esophageal varices. So you get inflammation of the esophageal varices, actually, I have to say, that comes from the liver struggling to detoxify all that alcohol, and you getting liver inflammation. So there's a lot of circulation going to the liver. And a varix is an inflamed blood vessel, and its backup of blood coming from the liver, also known as the portal circulation, and that's why you get esophageal varices. They can bleed, and then you can wind up getting bleeding in your esophagus, and you can also get cancer. So alcohol in general is going to be something that's going to irritate your esophagus, your lower esophageal sphincter, and your stomach. Okay, so then we go on to the other possible inflammatory foods, gluten. So modern wheat with its modern gluten in it it's inflammatory in everyone, make no mistake. And all these jokes about, you know, all the comedians like to do about, oh, gluten, ha ha ha, yeah, it's gluten-free. And, you know, somebody, I went to see School of Rock a couple of weeks ago, and they have a character who's kind of nerdy, and he's a nerdy, weak, pasty guy, and he says, I'm gluten intolerant, like that's a weakness. I'm like, ha ha ha, very funny. You know, I have to wonder what the world would be like if people stopped eating modern wheat. And I mean, the people in the blue zones where they're living to 100 years, they're not eating wheat. They're eating organic corn that's been processed in a way, a healthy, natural processed way, so that you get all of the nutrients out of the corn. They are not eating modern wheat. So they're not getting modern gluten. I don't have the same problem with einkorn, which is ancient wheat, that I do with modern wheat. Now, but however, having said that, if you have a problem with wheat and you have a problem with einkorn, shouldn't eat it if you have gastroesophageal reflux, because it will inflame any part of your digestive system. You have to remember that that gluten, regardless of the source, stimulates the zonulin pathway in your small intestine in everyone. It's just a matter of degree. And that zonulin pathway is an inflammatory pathway that's going to go ahead and start breaking up those tight junctions that are held together by glutamine, glutamine being an amino acid that's the primary source of energy for your small intestine. And it's going to break up those tight junctions so that you're more likely to get a leaky gut and you're going to absorb things that you're not supposed to absorb. But getting back to the stomach, if you eat modern wheat, it is one of the things that is likely to cause inflammation in your stomach, regardless of whether you're diagnosed with celiac disease or not. So it's something to check into. Then you have dairy, especially dairy from cow's milk, especially cow's milk that has not been grass-fed and has been pasteurized. However, cow's milk can be problematic for people because it's cow's milk. It was invented for cows. It was invented to take a baby cow from being a calf up to a 1 to 2 ton critter. It's not actually intended for humans. I'm not saying I don't eat it. I'm saying it is a possible inflammatory agent for a lot of people. Doesn't that make sense? Same with, now, people tend to react less to sheep and goat milk because sheep and goats are more our size. A kid and a lamb are about our size when they're born. They're born at, 8, 9, 10 pounds, and they grow up in an adult. Sheep and goat are about, again, they're about maybe 100 pounds or maybe a little more than that. And so they're about our size. So they have a similar proportion of fat, sugar, and protein as mother's milk, as human milk. So people tend to do a little bit better with those, but not necessarily. And I have to throw out there once again, as much as you love your ice cream and as much as today is Shavuot and today is the day you eat all the dairy, it's a Jewish holiday. And one of the traditions is that you eat dairy. You have a nice dairy meal on Shavuot. So today, a lot of people all over the place are going to be having ice cream parties and pizza parties and having cheese and crackers and, bagels and lox for dinner with cream cheese because it's dairy day. My cousin Sarah, she posted on Facebook today. She said, how is it that this bunch of people who are genetically, most of us are lactose intolerant, celebrate this holiday in the middle of summer with all this dairy? Having said that, Chag Sameach Shavuos. So anyway, wishing all of you a happy Shavuos and enjoy a little ice cream if you want. I know I'm going to. Having said that, if you have gastroesophageal reflux, dairy can still be inflammatory. And so it's something to look at. And I have to say, dairy, when you are a mammal and you are nursing on your mother, it is necessary to life. Once you have weaned from your mother, whether you're a human or a cow or a goat or a sheep or a bear or a deer, once you're done nursing and you are weaned and now you're eating whatever food your species eats, you no longer need to eat dairy ever again. So if you are a human and you stop eating dairy, you will not die. Children do not need to eat dairy after the age of weaning. Nobody needs to eat dairy after the age of weaning. I'm not saying you shouldn't eat dairy, but if it is inflaming you, there's good reason. And if it is inflaming you, maybe you want to consider not eating it. And if you have gastroesophageal reflux, the dairy can mess you up. So you might want to try not having it. Okay, so we talked about gluten, we talked about dairy. Grains in general, some people just don't do well with grains. And you have to remember that grains have anti-nutrients in them. They have phytates in them. I'm not saying, again, that you shouldn't ever eat grains. I'm just saying if you have an inflammatory condition, it's another thing that can cause inflammation. So you're talking about all the grains, whether they have gluten or not. So you're talking about your corn, your rice, your millet, your quinoa. Well, quinoa, amaranth, and buckwheat are not cereal grasses. So sometimes people do better with those than they do with the cereal grasses. So wheat, spelt, barley, oats, rye, millet, teff, kamut, these are all in the Poaceae family. They are all cereal grasses. So they all have some similarities to them. Corn as well. Did I say corn? Corn is a cereal grass as well. whereas quinoa and amaranth are amaranthaceae, and buckwheat is a polygonatum. They are not cereal grasses. So sometimes people do better with those, and you may or may not do better with those. So sometimes I'll do different levels of helping people with their food intolerance. I'll say just stay away from cereal grasses, but still eat quinoa, amaranth, and buckwheat if you can tolerate them. So anyway, grains in general can be, some people go on paleo diets and their reflux goes away, and that works for them. GMOs, if you're eating genetically modified organisms, and there are certain foods, you can look them up online, what the most common GMO foods are, things that you want to buy. Corn, if it's not organic, is often GMO. Cottonseed, canola, and soybeans are all tend to be GMO if they're not organic. So for certain foods, beets as well, zucchini and yellow squash tend to be genetically modified if they're not organic. So those foods you might want to look for organic if you have digestive upset. And so that's a whole other area. So those tend to be the inflammatory foods. The opportunistic irritants are going to be the things that tend to lower your sphincter tone. So those are going to be your mint and your spicy and your tomatoes and your coffee and tea. They relax the esophageal sphincter. I know if I drink too much coffee, I'll get heartburn, and chocolate as well, unfortunately. So those foods, they tend to be more opportunistic. And if you fix your digestion, sometimes you can go back to eating those foods, sometimes you can't. But the big thing for you is to be mindful about which foods are causing this and try to mostly stay away from those foods. Then there are things you can take that naturally to help with your esophageal reflux. Now, usually your MD is going to prescribe a proton pump inhibitor, and that's something that blocks the movement of hydrogen ions, so you make hydrochloric acid, so you have less hydrochloric acid. I already said that you don't have enough hydrochloric acid in the first place, so what sense does that make? Well, it will help if you have gastritis and if you have an ulcer. If you have less acid in there, you're going to be able to heal and you will be less symptomatic. But you're really only supposed to stay on those drugs for 2 weeks. That's what they say on them. And yet docs leave people on those drugs indefinitely, and they're really not supposed to. So it's really better to use natural medicine and help yourself to heal. You also might be given an H2 blocker like Tagamet or Zantac, your cimetidine and your ranitidine. And though if you're weaning from proton pump inhibitors, those are things that you can use. And those block one of the histamine receptors that's involved in hydrochloric acid production. And they tend to act much more rapidly than the proton pump inhibitors. And then you have Tums. What's the deal with Tums? Tums simply neutralizes stomach acid. It's calcium carbonate. It binds with hydrochloric acid. And it's going to make, calcium carbonate and hydrochloric acid. It's going to make bicarbonate. I guess it's going to make bicarbonate and calcium chloride, which is eventually going to lead you to hydrogen dioxide. It's going to lead you to water and carbon dioxide, and I guess calcium chloride. And calcium chloride you can then absorb and as a calcium supplement. But it neutralizes the stomach acid. That's how it works, and by making bicarbonate for you. But again, you're neutralizing your stomach acid, and you don't have the stomach acid to do all the other things that you need it to do. So what we do is we tend to give substances that reduce inflammation. Our favorite one is deglycyrrhizinated licorice. You don't need the glycyrrhizin in the licorice. Glycyrrhizin stimulates the adrenal glands, which can raise blood pressure. And for this purpose, you don't need that glycyrrhizin in there. We like to give deglycyrrhizinated licorice in powder or chewable forms because we want it to coat your whole esophagus. Unfortunately, you have the I never was raised on licorice syndrome. And so if you have a limited palate or, your parents didn't come home with Stella Doro anisette toast, or you're not Italian so you never drank ouzo, or not ouzo, Sambuca, or you're not Greek and you never drank ouzo, you're not going to have a taste for licorice. But if you're me, and you're, in my case, I was Jewish, I had the Stella Doro thing, and I was in New York, so we were surrounded by, you know, people giving us licorice. I like licorice. So the thing is, some people don't like the taste of licorice. So you can get the licorice in capsules. You're just not going to get as much of the benefit in the esophagus. So what it does is it improves the quality of the mucus and it reduces inflammation. Then there are all kinds of mucilaginous herbs that don't taste like licorice that are very pleasant. Marshmallow root is one of them. You can take that in tea. You can do plantain, both kinds of plantain, plantain that grows in your garden, your yard, Plantago ovata and Plantago lanceolata. They can be made into, tinctures and teas that can help. And also plantain bananas, ripe plantain bananas that are tropical fruit. They both work to reduce inflammation in your digestive system. And slippery elm, you can get slippery elm lozenges at the health food store. And they're often given for sore throats when they work great for the respiratory system. A lot of these mucilaginous herbs, they have multiple uses. They're great for the respiratory system. They're great for the digestive system. And they're great for the urinary tract. They're all like that. So you get a lot of benefit from them. And they all soothe and protect the digestive system. Aloe is another one. If you can do aloe juice or aloe drink, aloe is lovely for soothing the lining of the digestive system. And comfrey is another one. People forget about comfrey. Comfrey got a bad rap a few years back because somebody had liver disease and had way too much of it and hurt their liver. But comfrey in general is a wonderful healing herb, and it's really great for healing the digestive system. You can do comfrey tincture, comfrey tea. Calendula is another one. You know how you can put calendula cream on burns, on your hands, on your skin, and it'll heal whatever's on your skin? You can eat it too. It's great for your stomach. It's great for healing, healing ulcerations inside you as well. So calendula tea, calendula tincture, calendula succus, which is the fresh expressed juice with a little bit of alcohol, all wonderful herbs to help with reducing digestive inflammation. Probiotics. Don't forget probiotics. When you have a healthy balance of probiotics, that's going to help to set up the whole digestive system to behave better and to have more regularity and for things to flow through and to kill bad bacteria. So probiotics help too. Fermented foods in general. If you can tolerate dairy, kefir is wonderful. A good quality yogurt that's organic and doesn't have junk in it is wonderful. But kefir is better, I think, because kefir has way more probiotics and more retainable probiotics in it. Other fermented foods, fermented vegetables, kombucha, which is fermented tea, other fermented drinks, and fermented sauerkraut. Sauerkraut, which fermented sauerkraut, that's redundant. But sauerkraut, kimchi, fermented beets, carrots, pickles, name your fermented vegetable that you enjoy eating. You're going to get the benefits of the compounds that the probiotics make, and you're going to get the probiotics. So those are all ways that you can help. Also, if you have acute heartburn, drink a glass of water because the water is going to dilute the acid that's bothering you. That's the first thing to do if you're like, oh, my stomach hurts. First thing you can do if you're not about to get sick, drink some water. That'll dilute the hydrochloric acid and you'll feel better almost instantly. All right. So that's how gastroesophageal reflux works. Those are some things you can do for it, some ways you can eat, some things you can take. And if you have more questions, you can write me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. I will try to get this episode up quickly so that you can listen to it again and again. It will be available on iTunes, and it will be available at whus.org, where you can listen to the podcast anytime. Anyway, so you're listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. Thanks for listening to my treatise on gastroesophageal reflux disorder. You have been listening to me, Fran Storch, and this has been Radio Naturopath. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.